Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David Minister of 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbath Training Congregation on account of 12th Hour Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is August 24th, 2017, and it's evening 3, 2021. We will start our first service today with the song, A Leading on the Everlasting Arms.
What a fellowship, what a joy divine, leaning on the everlasting arms. What a blessedness, what a peace is mine, leaning on the everlasting arms. Leaning, leaning, safe and secure from all harm, leaning.
He wrote this about June 3rd, 1990. And I want to remind you that when Brother Johnson started his ministry, he, in 1968, when Yahweh called Brother Johnson to his office, and Brother Johnson recognized his identity, about biblical identity, as antitypical Joshua, the son of Nun. Now, that's the first thing he recognized. Because of the rod period, it was represented by Moses, that 40-year period, and that they were in the wilderness for 40 years, from 1930 to 1970. So, Brother Johnson was shown 2 years before that 40-year period was up for the rod that they would enter into a new period, and that he would be the new leader. And so Yahweh showed him all this and prepared him. For 2 years, Brother Johnson was prepared. Yahweh gave him the knowledge for the creation calendar to bring forth an instrument for the restoring all divine holy days, all the additional holy days to the seventh day Sabbath. Then he gave him all the divine institutions that need to be restored, including the sacred name Bible, the sacred name, And my wife now, she wasn't at the time, she gave him a Bible when she came back from Florida. I brought her back. She came back with a Sacred Name Bible, and she made him a present of the Sacred Name Bible. So Brother Jonathan, in order to restore all divine institutions, the number one divine institution that had to be restored was the Sacred Name. Now, having said all that, Brother Jonathan restored the Sacred Name when he started his ministry in 1970. And I joined him in 1970. So keep in mind now, Brother Jonathan had had 2 years of preparation here, from 68 to 70, to launch his, what he called his movement, which was the third step of the genuine movement of the Seventh-day Adventists, because of who he really turned up and ended up being, was the angel of the seventh candlestick, which simply means that he was placed in charge of the office of inspiration over the whole Seventh-day Adventist church, the shepherd's rod and with the Davidians and all. So, but the main message that he had, identity, was that he was Antiochus Joshua, the son of Nun. Well, it just so happens that there are two Joshuas that play a role in Brother Johnson's life. Joshua, the son of Nun, that one that succeeded Moses in the wilderness and took the children of Israel over into the land, promised land. And Moses stayed behind. He died, and he was resurrected and taken to heaven. And Joshua went on into the land with the children of Israel. So this is where Brother Johnson gets his identity from. And then, of course, we know what happened. At least 28 years later, Brother Johnson took hold of the identity of Joshua, the son of Josedek, there in Zechariah 3. So, anyway, the name Joshua is the most prominent, because Joshua is an English translation, I understand, for the name of Yeshua. And Yeshua is a name, is the name of the Father, meaning Yahweh is the salvation. So Yahshua's name is the Father's name. And so Joshua, if you put the Y in the place of the J, because that's all they had back then was the Y, and that Shua, S-H-U-A, is the same thing as on the name of Joshua. And so if you spell Joshua right, you have to spell Y-A-H-U-S-H-U-A, and that would be Joshua in the English translation. So, in essence, Brother Johnson was given Yahweh's name. Period. Okay. So, everyone gets Yahweh's name that's a prophet in these last days, as they got back then. Jeremiah had Yahweh's name attached to his name. Isaiah had Yahweh's name attached to his name. Elijah had Yahweh's name. Eliyahu. I have Yahweh's name. So, all Yahweh's servants has his name. Let's be called by his name. But Brother Johnson, of course, didn't understand that in 1970, but nevertheless, he played a significant role there. But I want to read something to you now from his tract, As It Was in Noah's Day. And he's on page 5, and it says, "It is indeed with humbleness," now this is Brother Johnson talking, "and gratitude that I can happily say I am a Christian Israelite, called of God to unite the Christian Gentiles with the Christian or Messianic Israelites, and to bring all people into the house of God. Now, I'm using these pagan terms just like he did, showing you what happened to Wörther. He started off in 1970, restoring the institution of the sacred name. And he wrote this tract in 1990, exactly 20 years later. And now he is using this pagan title for Satan, the god of this world. He reverted back to that. So, this right here is a sign that Wörther Johnson had apostatized from his high calling. So, because he would never humble himself enough to be called a Yahwehite, he would go an Israelite, Israelite, but he wouldn't go to be called a Yahshuaite or a Yahwehite. That would be too humbling. So he says here in 1990, it is indeed with humbleness and gratitude that I can happily say I am a Christian Israelite. Now this word Christian, he restored the name also in 1970 of Yeshua in the place of this here, and he restored the name Messiah in the place of Christ. So here he is using his pagan terminology, Christ, and put the IN on it, showing the followers of Christ today. When you use that word Christian, you're saying that you're a follower of Christ, and Christ is not Yahshua the Messiah. And the Greeks that changed that title, Christ is not even a name. It's a title. And it's a title today for pagan followers of the Catholic religion. In one form or another, it's the daughters of the Catholic Church that uses that term Christian, and the Adventist uses that term Christian. Everybody uses that term Christian. And I'm going to stop using it, period, for any reason. I'm going to put something else in the place of it. All right? Now, I know I've used it up to this day, but I'm using it now to show you the awfulness of it, that this is all pagan. And show you why Wörther Johnson did not succeed from right out the gate. In other words, when you go to a horse race, you're looking for a certain favorite horse to win. Okay? And usually you have a lineup of those horses, and you have a chart there that says, now this is the number one horse favorite to win. He's the best horse in the race. He has the best record. But others could come up and win. It doesn't necessarily mean that this number one horse is just automatically guaranteed to win. No. They put odds on him. They say, well, he's got a 4-1 odd to win. But he never has 100% odds to win. If that was the case, nobody would ever bet. And the bookies would never put up any money on a bet like that, where it was a cut and dried situation. But if it's a fixed deal, then yeah, they can fix the race to where any horse they want in that race to win. They can fix it. They can fix it in any kind of sports event for the one that they want to win, and then they can put their bets on that, and it's a crooked situation. Well, Wörther Johnson, he was the number one man. He was the latest person with the most experience He had the most latest knowledge, clear-cut knowledge of prophecy. And I mean, he was on top of his world as far as being the most qualified leader to take over from the Rod movement from 1930 to 1970. Out of all those Shepherd Rod people that John V.T. Hall started in 1930, all the way through that 40-year period, Willis Johnson emerged unscathed and in the right position with the latest pure knowledge. He's kept his priorities straight. He'd get sidetracked by Ben Roden, even though he joined Ben Roden after V.T. Hollis died. They joined up as a team. And he never did get sidetracked because he always went to the law and the testimony. And that's how he was able to not get sidetracked from anybody. And so, whenever Ben Roden was coming to his end, Roden Johnson recognized it. He knew the reason why he was coming to his end, because Yahweh had shown him. So Yahweh said, "Now I've chosen you to succeed him and teach my people my government." So Roden Johnson, he humbly accepted Yahweh's call. And he went to the mountains for 3 months upon a nice lake there in the mountains. And he meditated and he fasted and meditated and upon that creation calendar, and Yahweh gave him knowledge day by day. And he spent 3 months putting all that information together. So he humbled himself, very greatly humbled himself. And now here he comes along 20 years later, 1990, and he says, "It is indeed with humbleness and gratitude that I can happily say I am a Christian Israelite." Now, if he had been following his identity, biblical identity from 1970, he would have never used that word term, Christian Israelite. He would have said something like this if he had known who he really was. He would have said, "It is indeed with humbleness and gratitude that I can happily say that I have followed voice of Yahweh." And he would have used that term, Yahweh, from the time he called me in 1968 until now. And that he has instructed me that my title is Antitypical Joshua. And with that in mind, he would the right thing would say, "And I am a true believer in the office of inspiration, and that I have the title of a prophet, because I have the office of inspiration." And then he could have gone on from there and said, "My birth name is Brother W. Johnson, but my biblical name is Joshua." And if he had done his research, he'd say, "And that's two parts of the Father's name. It's the same thing as Elijah's name. Eliyahu." And then it would have been Joshua would be translated Yahushua. So, Elijah's name is translated Eliyahu. Yahushua would have been Moses' name. And so he could have gone on from there. But instead he says, I am a Christian Israelite. He's trying to appeal to the Adventist Christians. That's all they would go by. So he said, "Well, if I come off saying I'm antitypical Yahushua, and I don't use those pagan terminology," well, he felt like the Adventists would not even listen to him, and they wouldn't have. They wouldn't have. But Brother Johnson this message that he sent. He sent this message to the Adventists, just like it is, like it's written here. And it never did them any good. It never did them. He never got one convert from it. So, I'm saying, she don't give in and appease to the enemy. Because he won't accept anything, because as long as he thinks you're claiming the office of inspiration, and that you're an humble instrument of Yahweh, and claiming to be all humble and so forth, that no one will accept you. And that the Adventists will not accept him or even read his writings. Just the fact that he claimed to be a prophet with inspiration. Those that turned against Ellen G. White for the same reason. They turned against Vicki Howell for the same reason. They turned against Ben Rhodes and everybody else that's claiming the office of inspiration. But Brother Johnson didn't stick to his guns. He had the office of inspiration. And when I joined Brother Johnson, I said, my goodness, in 1970, I said, wow, this man has the office of inspiration. And I couldn't wait to go back to those Adventists, at those camp meetings in all those different Adventist churches. I visited 17, 18, 20 up there in the Dallas area for 10 years. They're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for 10 years, from 70 to 80. And my number one message then was, Brother Johnson is a prophet, and his name is Antithetical Joshua. That's the first thing, and I let the Adventists know, and Brother Johnson just cringed at that. He hated that. I said, Brother Johnson, I'm going to tell them the truth. He said, well, they'll just turn against you and me and against the message. They won't listen. I said, well, they did the same thing to Ellen G. White. They did the same thing to Ben Rhodes. And he says, yeah, but it won't work. It won't work. Yeah. Well, I kept doing it. And sure enough, it didn't work. Because Roland Johnson had apostatized and was using these pagan terminologies. Now, I have said enough on that. And I'm going to go ahead now and read Roland Johnson's tract. So every time I read his tract, I'm going to use the words that he used. And he used Christian, that's pagan. He used the word God, that's pagan, and I'm sure he's going to probably use Jesus and all that. That's all pagan, but I'm going to read it anyway. So it says, into the house of God, which is the house of prayer for all people. And I'm going to start over again. It is indeed with humbleness and gratitude that I can happily say, I am a Christian Israelite. Adventists just hated that terminology, Israelite. I know, I went to Sabbath school classes for 20 years, from 1970 to 1990, until this tract was written. I went to Sabbath school classes by the thousands over that last 20 years. And I would use that word. Sister White says we're the spiritual Israel today. Oh, and they would say, they would look at me and say, you're an offshoot. You're an offshoot. Just because I use that word Israelite. Okay. So anyway, they hated that. They didn't like the word Israel. They didn't like to be identified as an Israelite. And if anybody came claiming to be an Israelite, he was an imposter. He was an infiltrator. So I haven't said enough on that. Brother Johnson said, I can happily say I am a Christian Israelite, called of Yahweh, for the uniting of the Christian Gentiles with their Christian or Messianic Israelites. Now, he finally used this word Messianic Israelites. He finally used the sacred name. And to bring all people into the house of the Yahweh. Of course, Messianic is just a title. It's a title like Christian. So I can see why he used it there. Which is the house of prayer for all people. Isaiah 56:7. For the call is unto you, my brethren, to come and worship in the house of Yahweh. The decision is yours. And it's very important So think about it seriously. In 1988, I published two tracts entitled The Church and the Land. Now, church is another pagan title. The Greek terminology, I believe, is ecclesia. The Hebrew, the Jewish terminology is ecclesia. But Brother Jonathan wouldn't dare use that word ecclesia. He didn't want to use any of these Hebrew terminologies that had been turned into pagan words. He just wanted to use the pagan word because that's all they were familiar with, the people he was sending his message to. So he didn't want to offend them. He could have said, well, church, parentheses, ecclesia, he could have done that. He could have said Christian, messianic. He could have said God, parentheses, Yahweh, or Elohim. You know, he could have done that, but he wouldn't even do that. Okay, so I said, in 1998, I published two tracts entitled The Church and the Land, and 100 Years, 1888 to 1988, 1890 to 1990, Righteousness by Faith. These tracts were a warning that the antitypical two-year allotted time period for the Seventh-day Adventist leadership and ministry was in progress. We distributed these tracts at the historical 100-year anniversary celebration of the Righteousness by Faith, which the General Conference held with a special mini camp meeting in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in November of 1988 to commemorate the event that happened in 1888. These two tracts were also taken to most all of the camp meetings in the USA and some in Canada by our literature evangelists again in 1989. I printed two tracts entitled The Final Warning and Letter of Sionism and The Closed Door and distributed them at most all of the SDA camp meetings in the USA and some in Canada by our literature evangelists. The purpose of these tracts, and you know who Verla Johnson's literature evangelist was? Alan D. Long. Was one of them. I was another one, but I didn't go to Canada. Alan DeLong went to Canada with this with Brother Johnson's information. He was single at the time, I guess, and he was single at the time, and he was able. He had a new truck, and he was able to travel all over the United States and Canada, anywhere he wanted to go. And Brother Johnson sent him. So Brother Johnson was. And so they're both gone. Alan DeLong, he's apostatized. Brother Johnson apostatized. They're all apostatized. But this is what Brother Johnson is saying. The purpose of these tracts was to show the condition of the church. And now I'm going to put what he should have put. I'm going to put the parentheses, ecclesia. Because that's what he restored, all sacred names for everything in 1970. So I'm going to put what he should have put in there. And how to escape out of it. And a warning to put into the effect drastic measures to change her course of action or be lost. It also pointed out that the fifth angel's message is the final warning to the SDA church and then to the world. This salvation is fast coming unto a close, and we are nearing the end. These facts in themselves are proof that the fifth angel's message is a perfect antitype of the Noah's message and is a direct fulfillment of the Matthew 24:37-39. Now, we need to look at what we just read here and review what I just read, this last sentence. This salvation is fast coming unto a close, and we are nearing the end. Well, now he's correct in that we, in 1990, we were definitely, we're in the latter years. We weren't in the last days, we were in the latter years. According to Ezekiel 38:8 and verse 16, we're in the latter days and the latter years. That's a prophecy for this time as well, Ezekiel 38. Now, these facts in themselves are proof that the fifth angel's message is the perfect antitype of the Noah's message. Now, the three angels' message is not the perfect antitype for the Noah's message, but this is what Brother Johnson said. Your five angels' messages is a perfect antitype for the Noah's message, all five of them together. Because E.T. Hoddoff, he wrote a lot on in the rod about Noah and the flood. Made even a big chart on it. And he did the numerology on it. And Brother Johnson had his textbook right in front of him. And Brother Johnson, far as I know up to now, has never referred to V.T. Hoddoff's textbook on his information that V.T. Hoddoff wrote on the rod. He wrote 1,000 times more information on Noah and the flood as a type and antitype than Brother Johnson ever thought about that. And Brother Johnson had his textbook in front of him just like I do. And I use V.T. Hoddoff as it, because it's a letter rain of truth published in a book. Why wouldn't we use it? Ellen G. White's writings are the former rain of truth written in a book, and many books. V.T. Hoddoff wrote the former letter rain, the latter rain in many books. Alright? So it says, the fifth angel's message is the perfect antitype of the Noah's message and is a direct fulfillment of the Matthew 24:37-39. Well, this didn't even phase the Adventists. Not one Adventist responded to this message. Canada and everywhere. Nobody responded to it. Not one Adventist responded to it. Why? Because, number one, it wasn't time for this message to be published and sent to the Adventist or anybody else. It wasn't time for it. So inspiration was not at work here. Because without inspiration at work here and out of time, not at the right time, this is just a futile effort by Brother W. Johnson to try to get something new going in 1990. Because up to 1990, he had failed on the 1888 message, the 100-year centennial. He failed on his 1978 to 80, about that two-year period of righteousness by faith. Message to the Adventists, they just had a two-year period. We went to the General Conference, handout literature on that. And he wrote a tract, World Crisis, and so forth at that time. And none of it affected the Adventist Church. Not one thing that he ever wrote and published affected them, except the creation calendar. Now, the creation calendar is what produced all of these independent Seventh-day Adventists around the world that are keeping feast days. And it's all because of Brother W. Johnson's creation calendar that he published in 1970. You've got thousands of Adventists all over the world keeping holy feast days according to that calendar. And yet, I can go to these feast keepers and that are following. Well, the creation calendar gave birth to a multitude of other people create the publishing creation calendar. Brother Johnson was the pioneer of this in our day. And the Adventist independent feast keepers, and they broke off from the main body of the Seventh-day Adventists too. They're out in these woods in their own communities with their own ministers, and they're keeping these feast days. You have a big group right out there in California. And they call themselves Adventists too. And they have a leader, and they have a, his name is Vandenberg. They have a leader out there. And they, it's a big organization. They got a lot of Adventist peacekeepers. But they won't listen to me. Alan's going to them, and they wouldn't listen to Alan. Because it wasn't time. So follow up on Brother Johnson's creation calendar with any of these people. But the time is coming, because we're still publishing it. And 144,000 are going to, they're going to come to it, if they haven't already. So now it goes on to say, friends, this is Brother Johnson talking now. You can either be wise or be ignorant. You can either believe what you read and accept it as the truth, or you can close your mind to the truth and scoff it to scorn. Scoff it to scorn. You can either believe this message is an antitype of Noah's message and day, or you can reject the whole idea. You can either believe it is for you or it is not. You can either believe God's word or reject it. The decision is yours, and no one can change your mind. But you, however, there is one thing for sure, and that is whatever you do or think doesn't necessarily make you right, nor will it change Yahweh's plan or make his word false. If you go with the majority, you are sure to be wrong. But if you stick with the few, you are apt to be right. If because one chosen man is at the head of God's work, and it bothers you, then you have a real problem. For God has always chosen one man and put him at the head of his word all down through the ages. If what he is teaching is contrary to your thinking or learning, it doesn't necessarily mean that he is in error. If what he is teaching is not in complete harmony with what you believe, then he could be that he has new light or additional facts or a greater knowledge than you. So listen to the facts and investigate them for yourself. Now, here Brother Johnson is sending this literature, this message, to these Adventists worldwide that have been taken over by the Jesuits of the Catholic Church, and they are controlling what the ministers, the teachers in the great schools, the high schools, and the Adventist universities, controlling what they teach worldwide. And they teach nothing but theory and falsehood. It's all false. And so this is what Brother Johnson is sending this message to. These people with this dumbed down, twisted thinking of what truth is. They don't have a clue what truth is from their angle or anybody's angle. So the Brother Johnson And then here Brother Johnson has apostatized, and he doesn't even know what truth is anymore. And so it's a futile situation. So as the old saying, Brother Johnson was practicing an exercise in futility. It was just everything that he was doing was just going to end up in futility. In other words, in the trash bin. Everything that he was going to do from that point on would go in the trash bin in the end. So, he goes on to say that, be it known unto you that as a Bible teacher, I follow the rule of Isaiah 8:20. And I quote, to the law and to the testimony. If they speak not according unto this word, it is because there is no light in them. So Brother Johnson, that was his number one quote all through the years. And that was his number one quote when he was with the Rod from 1946. And he made that his guide. And that's what kept him safe and helped him to navigate through those waters of Viti Hadas. And while Viti Hadas was winding down and coming to his end, and nobody, none to help him, and nobody knew why, nobody except Brother Johnson kept the faith. He kept to the law and the testimony. And then when Ben Franz Hadden took over and claimed to be her husband's successor, for 5 years there, Brother Johnson followed that situation, but he kept to the law and the testimony. And then when Franz Hadolf twisted off and scattered everybody, Brother Johnson went with the next leader that emerged from there, and that was Ben Roden. And so he stayed with Ben Roden until up to about 1966, 67, 8, and he left Ben Roden. Because he was following the law and the testimony, and Ben Roden had gone completely off the course, and he wasn't. Ben Roden was no longer following the law and the testimony, so Brother Johnson left him. So Brother Johnson, this is true. He is very strong on following the law and the testimony. I will say that for his first 25 years as a shepherd, Rod. And in 1970, he followed the law and the testimony. But when new light came to him about restoring his divine institution, and with the sacred name being the first one, and giving a sacred name Bible, he couldn't make that step in that transition. He could not make that transition. So then, from that point on, because he did make the step. And he made the transition, and he announced it, and he tried to practice for 7 years, except he would not practice the daily. He also instituted the daily in 1970. He wouldn't enforce that, and he wouldn't enforce the sacred name. But the rest of them he could enforce. Tithe pan, yeah, he could enforce that. And he didn't even want to enforce tithe pan. He didn't even want to ask for the people's tithe. He wanted to start an on-site business to make money to support the ministry so he could have 100% control of his own ministry. Because he felt like tithe payers then would have a say in how he run his business. And finally, Yahweh raked him over the coals on that and knocked him down on that. And finally, he announced in the pulpit one day, well, he said, folks, I really got a chastisement from God. He said, he sent me a thing, and he said, you ought to take tithes from the people. So therefore, I'm going to stop trying to make money on the side to support this ministry, and I'm going to just depend on the tithes and the offerings to support this ministry. So he had to get knocked down on that. He just was so hard to, he could verbally and on paper restore all this stuff, in which he did. Creation calendar, he restored all the feasts at the right time. But he said he found that it was easy to keep the feast days according to creation calendar once he committed himself. Once he had the direction on how to do it, then that was the easiest part that he did, was restore the feast days and carefully made sure that he followed, setting those days aside for the next 33 years that I was with him. He was careful on that, always through the years. And then there was times when he didn't even get the feast days at the right time either because he was losing his way, but he was about 99% accurate all the way, but he wasn't 100% accurate on that. So it says, to the law and to the testimony, if they speak not according to his word, there's no light in them. For this reason, I firmly state that all my teachings are in accordance with the law and the testimony. Now, he's saying this in 1990, but if you were to go test against the thing that he wrote in the beginning in 1970, you'd find that this is not accurate. Because he had completed, did a 360-degree turn. Not 180, but a 360. He completely reversed, except he kept keeping the feast days. That's the only thing that he insisted on doing. Keeping the feast days at the appointed time. And the Brother Johnson's going to say now, and this is Brother Johnson talking, and that I am in perfect harmony with the everlasting gospel. Okay. And it's a statement, which is today being proclaimed through the fifth angel's message of Revelation 18:1-4. And now he says, those who reject this only soul-saving message of the day will perish in their sin. But those who accept will find safety in God's kingdom. The Bible teaches that it's David's everlasting kingdom, and that Yahshua comes and sits upon the throne of this everlasting kingdom, and that this is the kingdom of the Son. Okay, that the Son, it says there in the New Testament, that he delivers up to the Father when it's over with. But it's called the Son's kingdom, and then it says he delivers the whole thing up to the Father in the end. Okay, therefore, I invite you to join me here at Gilead Center in Kermit, Texas, for further study and understanding of the fifth angel's message and why it is the final warning unto the inhabitants of this world. So Brother Johnson is saying that what I'm sending to you in this little pamphlet here, this little tract, is the final warning. This is your final warning. If you don't come and he's sending this to 15 to 20 million Adventists around the world, they're supposed to get this message. So he says, if any of you fail to show up here now, he said, this is the final warning to the inhabitants of this world. You can also learn why Creation Calendar is the only instrument for the feast day, so make your calling and election sure. Now, he's absolutely 100% accurate on that. Creation Calendar is the most accurate timepiece ever published in the world. Now, he's accurate 100% on that. Because I still publish it because I inherited from him, and Yahweh said, I can back this up with Jeremiah 31 and so forth, and other scriptures of the Bible. Alright. The parallel of Adam and the SDA congregation, or church. Brother Sons are saying the parallel of Adam and the Seventh-day Adventist church. At this point, I want to draw your attention unto a devastating parallel. Brothers and sisters, I am talking about you, the Seventh-day Adventist Church and Adam. I want you to give me your undivided attention, for it is your only way out of the Laodiceanism. Or he says, of Laodiceanism. First, I am going to talk about Adam, and then I will talk about you. As you, the SDA Church, are a perfect parallel with Adam. To begin with, I want you to know that Adam was created by God, a perfect man. He was righteous in every way and clothed with a robe of righteousness, perhaps some kind of light. All things went well until Eve obeyed the serpent, the mouthpiece for Satan, and ate of the forbidden fruit. Since she was seemingly happy with her feeling of becoming wiser and being as God, she wanted to share her new knowledge with Adam. So she gave him some of the same fruit so that he could also be as God. She was carried away with the idea of sharing with Adam what she had learned and gained. Adam fell for her lying, and he also wound up in the devil's trap. But she knew that her plan had failed when things began to change. If only Eve had walked, had followed Yahweh's plan and said to Satan, "Let me talk to my husband first," then she would not have fallen into the Satan's trap and led her husband into the same trap also. If she would have been contented to be a helpmate and stayed by Adam's side, Satan could not have gained control of her. If Yahweh's original plan had been followed by the antitypical Eve, many wrongs could have been eliminated. As soon as Adam ate of the forbidden fruit, he and Eve saw a drastic change taking place that was shocking unto them. The Bible gives the facts. And the eyes of them both were open, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons, Genesis 3:7. These facts point out that by their disobedience of and action against the plan of the righteousness, they lost their robe of righteousness and became naked. So they had to make themselves clothing of fig leaves. As soon as Adam and Eve had sinned, Yahweh came down to the Garden of Eden, sacrificed two lambs, made them coats of skin, drove them out of the garden, set up the traveling sanctuary at the east gate of the Garden of Eden, and taught Adam the plan of salvation. And even though Adam lived to be 930 years old, he never regained his robe of righteousness, which he had become, he had before he fell. Well, but Adam did regain his robe of righteousness, but it was through acceptance of the plan of salvation through the blood of the everlasting covenant that he accepted and practiced and believed in, and the Bible says this is your righteousness. So Adam did was exchange one form of robe of righteousness for another robe of righteousness. So if Adam is going to be saved, and he was, he's in the record books to be resurrected, it means that he had on that robe of righteousness that was provided for man after he sinned. There's a robe of righteousness for a man, created for Adam in his perfect condition, and then after he sinned, he had to have that taken away. But he immediately was given a new robe of righteousness. Immediately that day. So Brother Johnson said, he's saying here, he never regained his robe of righteousness which he had before he fell. This is false. He did regain that robe of righteousness by practicing the ordained system of the true worship through the blood of the everlasting covenant, staying faithful to it all of his life. He did regain it. And when was it given to him? It was given to him the very day that he lost the one robe, he was given the other one. And if he, and if that rope wasn't given to him, he would have died. He would have died if he had to go out and practice the blood of sacrifice of the new and living way again, or the plan of salvation of the blood of the everlasting covenant. If he had to go out and practice that all of his life before he could be given that robe of righteousness at the end, he would have died. But the fact is, the records show that Adam never committed another sin. He lived for 930 years after he fell from the garden. He sinned that one time in the garden. It drove him out. He and Eve, the rest of their life, they never committed another sin. They lived a perfect life the rest of their life. They were living in a world of sin. They had fallen, but they lived a perfect life because there is no record. Because if they had committed another sin while they were out there in the world, tilling the soil, then they'd have been destroyed. Because they knew the way of righteousness from the beginning. All they knew is that they had to learn how to appropriate it. That's all they had to do. And they were willing to appropriate it to get back to the Garden of Eden. They couldn't stand the thought of not having eternal life. Even though they knew they were going to have to die someday, they wanted to ensure that they'd have eternal life when they did die. And that was what John says right there in John chapter 2. He said, "My little children, these things write on you if you sin not. And if any man sin, we have an advocate." And I'm going to read that and close this sermon right on out. All right? In 1 John chapter 2. "My little children, these things write I unto you that you sin not. And if any man sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Yeshua Messiah the righteous." Okay. So, Adam and Eve, they were taught the plan of salvation. Now Moses was taught to given a diagram on a pattern of the plan of salvation up there in the mount when he brought the children of Israel out of Egypt. And the record shows that Moses never committed one sin. There is not a record where he only committed one sin, and that was the end of his life, when he finished the 40-year period in the wilderness. Because he was taught by his parents to follow the plan of salvation through the blood of the everlasting covenant. There is not one record where it shows Moses ever committed one sin the whole 120 years of his life, except right at the end. And Yahweh told him so. He says, "You sinned when you smoked that rock twice." And Yahweh come down and told him so. He said, "Because of your sin and yours and Aaron," he said, "I cannot let you enter into the promised land." One sin kept him out of the promised land. So, Adam and Eve knew how to not sin anymore. They were taught right at the beginning. It's like Moses was taught by his parents how to not sin. There's not one record that Enoch ever sinned. He lived 365 years, went to heaven. There's not one record that he ever committed that one sin. I guarantee you, if any righteous person or prophet had ever committed one sin, it would be on record. David committed a terrible sin, and brother, it was put on record. But after he repented of that, and Yahweh forgave him and blotted out his iniquity there in Psalm 32, then there's no record that David ever committed another sin the rest of his life. That's the reason why John right here is telling these little children, once you learn how to the plan of salvation, how to get rid of your sins, he said, once you get rid of them, he said, don't sin no more. That's what he's telling us right here. So that's what Yahweh's telling me today, folks. Well, this is the gist of my sermon today, and so This brings the first of our study this hour. You can contact us at the 11th hour call, and that's number 11. Click on my audio archives and hear this message, and then we're going to close now with a song. Dusty Roads and Sandal Feet. Reason to believe in that man of Galilee, for he walked those dusty roads to me and me. Often tossed it, and had his burden all alone, as he journeyed along that road to Calvary. Dusty roads and no feet, ordinary verse and feet, come the manger to the cross. Take the road and streets to a place in the land where someday we all shall meet. The author of the story, dusty roads and old feet. I have reason to believe in that man of Galilee, for there's nothing in this world he couldn't do. Change the water into wine, cast out demons, heal the blind. And that's why I believe in that man of Galilee. Dusty road for his companion, desert places, his abode. Sandal feet, they're often weary underneath a heavy load. Never complaining as he went along the way, on the way to the Calvary and the judgment day. Dusty road, sandal feet, how would you like to be that man in Joshua, coming down your street? Would you be like Zacchaeus, sometime a man of truth? Or would you be like Jonah, who wanted to be? Dusty road, sandal feet, how the journey was complete, from the manger to the cross. The author of the story, dusty roads and sandal feet.